is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Happy time of the light. Happy winter solstice. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. I think Ramadan was quite a while ago. I think it moves more than these others do. I was taught to celebrate the winter solstice, and that it was a Druid holiday. Of course, I think that any culture that pays attention in the Northern Hemisphere, especially once you get a little north of the equator, I guess, notices that the days are getting longer. And that's cause for celebration. And I was taught that all of these holidays grow out of these ancient natural celebrations. So happy whatever it is, all of the above. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Zen mind, beginner's mind, because as you may well know, this is the time of the 50th anniversary of its publication. It was celebrated in Buddha Dharma. And I tell you, I went looking for a copy of it in the library and in my side with the reserved books and with all the books that I have upstairs. I couldn't find one. And I think we've had more than one here. And I guess they're out. However, there's a PDF, of course, but also I listened to Paul Haller's talk about the first section, I guess, or part of the first section. And then also there was a wonderful issue of Buddha Dharma not long ago that celebrated it and had the lecture on posture, and it had various commentaries by all kinds of people about what it was for them when they read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And reading these sections, it just came back to me how, because I haven't read it in a while, but he was really good at incorporating complicated ideas into his talks. They were given at the Los Altos. There was like a sitting group down the peninsula, and he used to visit there once a week. And then I wrote her name down, Marion somebody transcribed them, which is really hard, and it was harder then than it is now. So it's in Marion Derby, and then Trudy Dixon edited them, because I don't know if you've ever seen a transcript of something that you, a lecture that you gave or a class that you taught orally. It's really embarrassing. You wonder how anybody could have paid attention. So it's not easy to put it into a form that works on the page. She did it. And he once said that he was really pleased with it, and he thought that it really reflected Trudy's understanding well. But I think, and I think that it reflects his understanding too. And I have to add something I about Sojin, about Mel. I've heard it said about Suzuki Roshi that he, you know, he taught by doing, just by being who he was and living in the world that he occupied. Mel in the Buddha Dharma commentary talks about how this was seeing Suzuki Roshi at the old temple in San Francisco. He just kept doing the same thing every day. He'd come out of his office, he'd open the zendo, he'd make the offering, he'd sit zazen, and then he would bow with each person and then they'd do service, and then he would bow with each person as they left, and that's it. And he did that every day. And Mel was deeply moved by that Suzuki Roshi could do that, and that every time he did it was fresh. Every time was a new moment. You know that that Suzuki Roshi completely occupied it, and Mel was talking recently, I don't remember exactly the context, but at any rate, he said that what he really likes is to do things with people, cook with them, work in the garden, that kind of thing, and woodworking. There are a lot of people that really bonded with him over woodworking. At Tassajara, you know, there's a real shop with the kind of tools that make this kind of thing. So you've heard this, I'm sure. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind, there are few. It's such a useful thing to remember. And we need to become skilled at various things, but with that mind that's still open. You know, it's sort of a way, it's when I say, you know, with the mind of emptiness, that's a more heady way of saying the same thing. So Paul talked about a lot of the lectures or fascicles or whatever you'd call them in the first section, which is right practice, the first section of Zen My Beginner's Mind. And Buddha Dharma had the first one, which is posture. So maybe I'll start with that one. He said the most important. He's famous as is Mel for saying the most important thing, and then 5 minutes later, he's talking about something else, and he says, this is the most important thing. So the most important thing in taking the Zazen posture is to keep your spine straight. Keep your spine straight. Reaching, uprightness. And he doesn't mean literally straight like a board, just in case there was the slightest doubt. And he has a wonderful, a lot of what he says there is, I'm going to say cribbed from the Fukan Sazengi, which we recite when we sit all day. You know, when we're not in practice period, you know, keep your nose in line with your navel and your ears in line with your shoulders. Don't, you know, does it say your head aligned with your spine? I don't remember if it says it in there. We say it. But at any rate, he says, and He says about the mudra, your hands should form the cosmic mudra. If you put your left hand on top of your right, middle joints of your middle fingers together, and touch your thumbs lightly together as if you held a piece of paper between them, your hands will make a beautiful oval. You should keep this universal mudra with great care, as if you were holding something very precious in your hand. Your hands should be held against your body with your thumbs about the height of your navel. Hold your arms freely and easily and slightly away from your body as if you held an egg under each arm without breaking it. And I say that to people. And as you give Zazen instruction, you will say that to people. It's a kind of a funny image to think about holding an egg under your arm. I hear something whistling, but I can't think it's a dog. It doesn't sound like a dog. And I know I didn't leave the kettle on. Anyway, it's just a little distracting. But anyway, it's a great image because it's just, it's just like, not out here, not like this, but just relaxed. And you'd have to be relaxed. You couldn't press too hard. You might crack the egg, which would be seriously unpleasant, right? Slightly away from your body, as if you held an egg under each arm without breaking it. It's a wonderful image. And as we continue to use that image, which I don't think it's in the Fukan Sozengi, but it's probably pretty standard. I don't know if it's just our lineage, but I think I'll bet you it's pretty standard, but it's a good image and it will go on. So not just, he died in, 71? Right about this time of year. It's commemorated at the Berkeley Zen Center always that evening. And people form, it's usually during the, what's called the Rohatsu Sesshin, which honors Buddha's enlightenment, December 8. There's another time of light at the time of the winter solstice, or close enough. At any rate, everybody forms a big oval and takes turns going up and bowing to Suzuki Roshi. His photograph is on the altar, and so you get a chance to bow to him and tell him whatever you want, what you're grateful for, or whatever you want to say to him. And it's very sweet. And so then, the circle just keeps going around until everybody winds up back in their original place. And it's a reminder, I think, that he's with us. Even if we didn't know him, he's with us. And I feel his support. I hope you do. Because I know people that knew him well. Sojin knew him very well. Blanche knew him very well. Reb knew him very well. And I can't help but think that the same is true with Mel. I don't know how much longer he's going to be around, and he'll always be around. And just so you know, I probably said this before to you guys, but Mel walks like Suzuki Roshi. And I didn't know that, but when I met Hoitsu, Suzuki Roshi's son, at some point somebody said, he walks just like his father. And I thought, well, Mel walks just like Hoitsu. I think their bond was very much physical, body to body kind of thing, heart thing. And it is with Hoetsu too. I don't know if you watched Mel's stepping down ceremony, but when he and Hoetsu saw each other, they both just lit up. Suzuki Roshi said, still on posture, these forms are not a means of obtaining the right state of mind. To take this posture is itself the purpose of our practice. So I will add that to wholeheartedly take this posture is the right state of mind, whatever that may be. And he goes on to say to keep that posture, the right posture, and all of it, what you do. Own your own physical body. He says this is the true teaching, not so much the books. This is the true teaching. The next section was breathing. He said, what we call I is just a swinging door that moves when we inhale and when we exhale. It's just a swinging door that moves when we inhale and when we exhale. Not such a big thing. But the most important thing at all, right? If you don't inhale again, you're dead. It's just a swinging door. Control. This is the one that's famous. It's also often referred to as horses, but to give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control it. A large meadow. See what somebody will do. Give them a chance. I'm just going to touch on these, and then we can talk about them. Mind waves is the fourth chapter in that section, in that part. Mind waves. Because we enjoy all aspects of life as an unfolding of big mind, we do not care for excessive joy, so we have imperturbable composure. That's easy to say and not so easy to do, but I think it's good to remember it. You know, he doesn't say no joy. He says excessive joy. Not getting too excited, which is probably goes hand in hand with being too attached to it. And then it's doubly hard when you lose it. And that holding it lightly is conducive to composure. Imperturbable. Maybe that's our direction. Not our goal, of course, but our direction. And I do think we just don't, you know, I haven't used this image in a while, but we don't lurch so much. You know, we do this sometimes a little too far, but we're not this way. And number five was mind weeds. you should rather be grateful for the weeds you have in your mind, the weeds you have in your mind, because eventually they will enrich your practice. Eventually they will enrich your practice. And you know that that's true. It seems like lately, I don't remember to whom, and it may well be none of you, or it might be some of you, that I've been saying, I've said this for a while, that one of my mantras is okay and phooey. You get, you know, you kind of get to complain. And you kind of have to accept whatever it is. You don't, of course, you don't have to. You can torture yourself if you prefer. But things go easier if we accept it, even if there's a little phooey in that acceptance. Sue Farrell fell, you know, and she's having a really hard time. And she's working on learning how to stand up and walk. And she just feels low about it. It's hard. It doesn't come easy. And you know, it seems like it's taking, I mean, I'm projecting from my own experience of physical therapy for my elbow and my hand. You know, it seems like nothing ever changes, you know, because it's so, these little tiny steps, you know. But you have to do that stuff. Again, you don't have to, but better to do it. We'll all support each other in this. So I wondered, for many people that come to Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is a really important book, and it's been very encouraging. And every time I go back to it, I think, wow. And maybe this fall, coming fall practice period, maybe we'll do Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, or pick out some fascicles from it, something like that. I don't know. Anyway, I just wondered, how was it for you? Do you have a relationship with that book? And if so, what? Or was it really important to you in starting out, or now, or something completely different? Zach?
Well, a while back, I bought a copy and read it. I've read it since then, but I found that going through some books, I already had a copy. So I bought it twice. So I can bring one or drop one off to the library or whatever. It's an amazing book, especially when you're a beginner and you maybe don't understand the particulars, but you sort of get the gestalt or whatever of it. And it's an amazing lesson. There are amazing lessons there that I think you can get something from, even though you're not a graduate student of Zen. So I'd love to study it. I think I've read it a couple times over the years, and if I had to pick one book to give somebody who was interested in Zen, I would definitely give them that book, I think.
Kate?
Yeah, I I love that book as well. And it was important to me when I first started practicing. And then I always have a copy on my nightstand with a stack of other things, and we'll pull it out from time to time. But I found, particularly during this last session and practice period, but particularly the session, I found myself trying really hard to do everything really right, you know, and I realized I was putting this unnecessary pressure on myself. But something said, you need to go back to that book. And I did. And I reread one of my favorite sections called The Marrow of Zen. And it always brings me back home, you know, to what's important, what's real, and what's meaningful in my practice, you know, what all this effort is about, I guess, you know, and it eases me, you know, it eases something in me. It puts me more at ease for some reason. That's all I can say.
Steve?
Yeah, to me it was also, I'm echoing what Zach and Kate have said, that it's really been a gateway early on in my introduction to Zen, like particularly the first chapter where he speaks about the posture as the practice itself, and not trying to be enlightened. It's not a special state of mind, especially that Zen is not a special state of mind. It's such a paradox. It's almost like a beginner's koan. You know, what do you, and when I later gave Zazen instruction, I have always held not just the Kukans of Zengi, but especially that first essay in the back of my mind somewhere, and to try to make that what I emphasize, that it's not about getting anywhere. It's about it's about the posture. It's about the breathing. And I'm also always amazed when people say his English wasn't that good at that time, yet he wrote that poetry. I mean, as edited, it comes across as poetry. So yeah. Maybe there were some errs and ahs in between, or fumbling for words that were edited out, but I love it. And I don't even have a copy for some reason.
You know, I think you can find on the Crooked Cucumber website, you can find some audio recordings, and it was partly his English, it was partly his accent. Mm-hmm. And these have been heavily, heavily edited. People say that as they listened to him, at first it was that they couldn't understand him at all, and then after a while they kind of began to get the rhythm of it, and they felt that they could understand him. But I think it was, what I've heard, a little bits and pieces, it was difficult. So maybe we do have more of Trudy Dixon than we think. I don't know. Lisa?
I think it was the first book I read of Buddhism, I think it was. And I've read it hundreds of times. And it also really applies. I remember one time, one of the first times I was reading it, I kept underlining things because it really also applied to art, making art. And then it's so interesting. Last night, a friend mentioned a Tibetan teacher. I can't remember his name right now. Somebody that I didn't know. And I was sort of, I looked him up and I listened to a talk that he gave, and he was talking about, he gave a talk at the very beginning of the coronavirus. So he was talking about fear and becoming like dancing with fear or something like that. It sounds very Pema, like dancing with fear. And he was talking about playfulness as the aspect of a wakeful mind, like enlightened mind is playful. And I thought, oh, wow, that's right. The Tibetans have that. There is that flavor of playfulness. And I was thinking, Zen isn't very playful. Like, I was thinking, Dogen isn't very playful. Like, Bodhidharma doesn't strike me as a playful fellow. And then when I was sitting just now, I thought, oh, but Suzuki Roshi, he was playful. He strikes me as really playful. And that's the spirit of that book. And the spirit of Beginner's Mind is that kind of light. Like, yeah, he's talking about these very profound things, but there's a lightness to it that feels spacious and playful in a way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. That's my impression, too.
Yeah.
Hakuin was funny. Hakuin had a great sense of humor, but I think he was very rough, very hard on his monks, so I don't know if he was playful with them. But I think I have that impression. And Sunny, I don't want you to feel pressured, but please feel invited to jump in if you like. Okay. But it's.
I mean, I should read that book. But a couple of nights ago, we were getting ready to go to sleep, and. Oh, I just started thinking. I looked there and went, I think I'm enlightened. I think I was thinking, remain present without distraction. And I was just thinking, we're so distracted. You know, of course, you got to get a laugh out of that. But I caught myself waking up in the middle of the night for a midnight snack. I went to eat a quesadilla I made, and I was just inhaling it. And I put my phone down. I said, leave your phone. Put the phone back in the bedroom. Just eat. Just eat. And it was hard. I had to really... just eat, chew it. I was just inhaling this thing. And it was kind of interesting. This kid came over to do some recording training the next day, a young man. And I mentioned that, I mentioned a comment to remain centered in the midst of chaos. He's like, is that a karate thing? What is that? Is that like a, I went, no, it's actually from a yoga instructor on YouTube. But, but I said, it's true. We try to remain present in the midst of everything going on, you know, I gave him the example of me trying to eat that snack and not look at my phone and not try to just eat. And he goes, I have that problem too. It's hard. He's like 18 years old.
Yeah.
It is hard. Just to be present. But so I think I will take a look at the book. I have it.
I know where it is.
I know that too, but it's just to remain present without distraction. And I thought, okay, that's me, my new saying, just to try to be present, and it's very difficult.
That's right. Well, what you see is how distracted you are.
Yeah, oh, God, yeah. So, but thank you.
Thanks. Kelly?
Yeah, I think what's remarkable for me about that book is that I find it a great deal more useful now than when I first read it. I think when I first read it, I was like, this is very lovely, but it's very aphoristic and great. Oh, and now I can go back to it. And, you know, I can get very obsessy about stuff like posture is a great example. Like I will way worry too much about my posture. And I can go back to that book and read what he said about posture. And it's like it wipes the slate clean. And says, oh, wait a minute, this is a lot more simple than I'm making it. And I just, I find it, so, well, it starts me at the beginning again. And I find that so incredibly useful. So I still grab for it a lot. It seems to get more useful to me as time goes by.
Well, thank you, everybody. It inspires me that you're inspired, you know, and it is true that there's a lot there. And when you read it early on, you get X out of it, and then later you get Z out of it. You know, that he's referring to things that you you know about, you know, and you start to see bits and pieces of, you see Dogen in there for sure, but you also see like Nagarjuna about emptiness or that kind of thing, or some notion about how the self operates or something like that. And he is referring to these things and talking about them, but not in a way that's erudite. And I think that that chapter called, you know, the, what is it, the marrow of practice. I did not reread it, but, you know, there's a very famous exchange by Bodhidharma with his students. And I think he was quite ill. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I think so. And at any rate, he asked his students to show their understanding. And the first one said something or whatever. And he said, "You have my skin." And then the next one said something else, and he said, "You have my flesh." And the female one said something or another, and he said, "You have my bones." And Huike just out, and he said, "You have my marrow." And there's a, you know, that, no, he didn't put the title on that section, I'm sure, so. And I can't remember if he talked about that in it, because if it's just that it's on the title, that's Trudy Dixon's understanding. But I think he probably did, you know, and he may or may not have explained that. And then, of course, there's a Dogen fascicle that takes that and scrambles it. So, you know, why do we always say that the one that said the marrow, he was the one, he was like the winner. That's not so clear. And then he pulls the rug out from under you. It's the Raihai Tokuzui or Tokuji, something like that. And that's the one where Dogen talks about women having just the same capacity as men for enlightenment. So I hope that you enjoy these next couple of weeks, and let some light in, and enjoy the rain. I know it's been raining here. Lisa, we got about a quarter of an inch. It's really wet, so that's thrilling. Last night I was reading, and I noticed the sound of it. You know, so I right over my shoulder practically, and such a delightful sound. So let us formally end this, and then we can chat a little bit if you want to.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.